very much, and thanks for asking me to come and speak to you this evening. And yes, the title of my... Ooh, that's funny, isn't it? The title of my talk is as... Let me just try... Because it was on there.
Right. Here, I can just continue. I'll try.
So the title of the talk is as on the slide, and indeed, which is from the cover of my book, The Psychology of Christian Character Formation. And what I'll do this evening is just talk a little bit about some issues around the relationship between psychology and theology. And then I'll go on to talk a little bit about why I wrote the book and just draw a few themes from this very big topic out for us to explore a little more. And before I wrote this book, I had another book in mind, which had a different kind of title, which was this, Using Good Psychology for Better Theology, which is an idea for a title that I got from a conversation with a student where I teach at Ripon College Cuddesdon. This student was a clinical psychologist who had felt called to full-time Christian ministry, so he was undergoing ordination training when I was teaching some sessions on psychology. Before I was working full-time at Ripon College Cuddesdon, I was going to do sessions, and I'd come in to teach this group, and he told me of his sadness that the church doesn't have access to very good psychology, and his passion for bringing good psychology to bear on the process of doing theology so that it could be done better. And I found that quite an inspirational idea. I think it had always been my passion as well, but I thought he put it rather well. So I have this title on this slide just as a way in for us to explore, or for me to set out for you, essentially what psychology and good psychology might look like and how it might help us do theology better. And then kind of focus down on the idea of character formation as one aspect of that. So, what is psychology? Well, one thing I would say that isn't up there is that it's not philosophy. And I've already talked to a couple of you tonight who are clearly philosophers. And the area I'm talking about, actually, is of great interest to philosophers as well. It probably will be interesting for you to pull out the differences in the approach a psychologist would take to some of these issues. And hopefully we'll talk about them in discussion. I guess one of the big differences between philosophy and psychology is the empirical emphasis in psychology. That definition that I've got up here, there, the scientific study of behaviour and mental processes, is drawn from a mainstream, it's a North American textbook, Dave Meyer's big undergraduate textbook for psychology. You get very similar definitions in Britain and in many North European countries as well. I've said human beings there. Some definitions expand psychology to non-human animals as well. And essentially, it's the study of people, people's thinking, people's feeling, people's behaviour, and people in relationship. So the charge that's often levelled against psychology, which is that it's highly individualist and dealing with what's going on inside people's heads, is probably not a fair charge. It's a charge you might label at some early forms of psychoanalysis, I guess, but I don't think psychology has been particularly guilty of studying what goes on in the inside of individuals' heads. If anything, it's been more guilty of emphasising too much what individuals do. But it's also interested in how people relate. You can't study individuals without thinking about relationships, one-on-one relationships, or indeed group processes. Having said what psychology has come on to, well, what is good psychology? And I've organised my understanding of what good psychology is around the Platonic triad of truth, goodness, and beauty. So just bearing in mind that, because there are some philosophers here, that of course each of those concepts has its problems, but going with it for the moment. The truth idea, psychology needs to have a sound evidence base in empirical research if it is to have any claim to what psychologists would call validity. They don't tend to use the word truth. And I would say that that empirical research could be both quantitative, either quantitative or qualitative, preferably both. Goodness is something about the need for psychology to be ethically self-aware. That means that it shouldn't be morally prescriptive. Again, some of the psychotherapeutic disciplines have tended to be morally prescriptive in the past. I think psychology is more better aware of that now. And it should not exceed its limits. And the best example of a psychologist who did exceed their limits, I guess, would be Sigmund Freud, who sets up a whole essentially metaphysical system and calls it psychology. Again, psychology is not trying to do that, and it shouldn't be doing that. And if individual psychologists start doing that, then they should say they're not doing psychology anymore. Although, of course, the type of psychology you do will be based on certain kinds of assumptions about the way the world is, but those are usually stated and open to dispute if necessary. The other thing I've said there is that it shouldn't, and I did think psychology has been guilty of this in the past, make unwarranted claims about cultural universality. I think we're understanding more and more that you, when you say something about how people behave in a particular study, you're talking about how the people, the individuals who participated in that study are behaving. And the onus is on you then to demonstrate how generalizable your claims are to other individuals and other situations and other cultures. Again, I think psychology on the whole is well aware of that issue now, but in the past it may have been a bit of a difficulty. And then largely the idea of beauty. I think like any scientific theory, there's a kind of tension between wanting to achieve elegant accounts of the way people behave, the way people think, the way people relate and feel, and accounts that are complex enough to do justice to the phenomena and to generate research and to be creative in the generation of ideas. So there should be no unnecessary hypotheses in psychology, and there should be no so what theory. And there have been the odd type of so what theories kicking around in psychology in the past, which essentially just re-describe the way things are, but don't take you much further than that. Just a quick definition of theology. Both of those definitions, which I like because they emphasise the human nature of the theological enterprise, that theology is something that people do. And you have in Alistair McGrath's definition at the top, you have the idea not just that people do theology, but they're doing it in relationship to a God to whom they behave in a certain way, but to whom they're also orientated in a certain way. And I like Rana's phrase, the science of faith, because it invites us to think about theology as an enterprise that might have a methodology that is analogous to that of the sciences. And I think that theology could learn quite a bit from scientific methodology. And so I think that's an intriguing description by Rana. In the one level, it's kind of highly cognitive, the idea of science, but then he talks about faith, which is something relational and affective. So, as it says up there, both definitions emphasise the contribution of cognition, emotion, action, and relationship. So what might better theology look like? If you were using good psychology to do better theology, I think it would be, first of all, a theology that was systematically and intentionally connected to human concerns, that actually had some relevance to the way people live their lives here and now as they receive the Christian story, we're thinking about Christian theology in particular. So doing a kind of systematic theology that has no relevance to the life of and the questions that real people are asking, as I think is less good theology in that sense. Secondly, and this is where I think psychology might, psychology clearly might help the first of those two aspirations. The second one is, I think theology, and this relates to what I said about theology and science, is kind of looking for metaphors and models to help it do its work all the time. And sometimes it finds itself stuck with metaphors from the past, which have done their job and to a degree continue to do their job, but actually might also be a little bit past their sell-by date. And the need to draw new metaphors into the practice of theology is important. So Nancy Murphy, who is a philosopher based at Fuller Seminary, that's from her 1993 book, whose title escapes me for the moment, talks about the need for good scientific metaphors to help people do theology better. And I think psychological metaphors might be invoked as well. So the kind of areas that you might think about scientific metaphor helping might be in thinking about substance and material around the question of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharistic elements, for instance. And the area where, or an example of an area where maybe neuroscience might help us is in Christian anthropology, understanding what it might mean to be a human person. In a way, there are challenges from neuroscience to traditional Christian understandings of the human person, but there's also potential resources in the neurosciences for exploring more, in more depth, theologically, what it might mean to be a fully human person. Another example, I think, where there is lots of potential knowledge, and some people have used it a bit, probably mainly me, actually, but is attachment theory, which if you are, whether or not you're a psychologist, you'll probably come across attachment theory, and I'll allude to it a bit tonight, but understanding the nature of infant-parent relationships, I think, properly, helps us in our understanding of the parental relationship that we, as Christian faithful people, have with our Creator. This is a version of a slide I just showed last week to a group of people, which I've tweaked even since then. And it's picking up this idea of science and faith and comparing scientific endeavours with theological endeavours. And I think really all I want to say about the slide is, I always say that and then I start talking through the whole slide, but the main point of the slide is that the difference between theological explanations and scientific explanations or accounts of phenomena are that theological accounts have an unrestricted use of agency. That is, theological accounts are prepared to invoke super-empirical agents to explain. So a theological account would invoke the action of the Holy Spirit, for instance, to explain things that happened. Whereas a scientific account, that would include psychology, would not invoke super-empirical agents. That's the main difference between them. I think the only other thing I'll say is just talk you through the things that are in this white grid to just plant the suggestion in your mind that actually, as well as science and theology being different from each other in the respects that I've just suggested, there are also different ways of doing science and different ways of doing theology that are analogous to each other, which you might say are the kind of popular default setting way of thinking and the more articulated, unnatural, trained way of thinking in both domains. So I've given, as an example, in theology, the doctrine of the Trinity, which is an unnatural, difficult concept that you need to do a lot of thinking and wrestling and setting aside preconceptions to wrestle with, and the kind of God found me a parking place, which is a natural way of thinking, an easy way of thinking, and you find yourself saying, why am I thinking like this when I know it's ridiculous kind of difference? And you get a similar difference in science. You have theories that take effort to understand. They take enrollment in a period of study which has very specific rules of engagement and supervision belonging to a particular kind of scientific community. And then you have naturalistic kind of scientific thinking, so the kind of what it's obvious that a ton of rocks would weigh more than a ton of feathers kind of naturalistic thinking. I can remember as a child, people used to tell that, ask you that as a riddle in the school playground, which weighs more, and you'd say, well, obviously a ton of rocks, and then they'd laugh at you, and that's the way you learn as a child about your stupid assumptions about the world. And whenever I show this slide, I just make the point that in the new atheists, particularly the more kind of radical new atheists, by radical I mean kind of hostile new atheists, so it's a misuse of the word radical, I guess. Let's take Richard Dawkins, do this funny thing of, naughty thing, I think, of comparing this with this, rather than this with this. So they compare elaborate, trained scientific thinking with default settings, naturalistic, populist theological thinking. So they're comparing apples with pears. So theology and science, the main difference being the idea of agency, to come back to. So when I was thinking about, well, how might the science of psychology inform the enterprise of theology, I came up with a whole list of ideas. Something about understanding the process of revelation. What is going on when we hear the voice of God or have a vision? Or just have a sense that this is right, or a word from the Bible leaps out at us. Something about Christian anthropology I've already mentioned, so the ones I put in blue are things that I've written something on or am working on. So I'm interested in understanding Christian anthropology, taking into account findings of neuroscience, and especially clinical cases. The psychology of memory ought to really help us, given that we're interested in tradition and the passing on of tradition and what we do as story. Might psychology help us in reading the Bible? So I've done a long piece of research on that, which is published. Something about community relations. Surely social psychology should help us with that. Something about making disciples, which is what we're going to look at this evening. Something about apologetics. Surely psychology ought to be able to help us tell the Christian story in a way that makes sense, a good sense to people, not just culturally, but psychologically, and wrestling with doctrine, which I'm not going to talk about. It's in yellow just because I made a mistake, so really what needs to be in yellow is making disciples, because that's this thing about character formation is what I want to look at. Now, when I was kind of mulling all this over, I was working at Heathrop College in London, and I was teaching psychology there. I was teaching psychology of religion to graduate students, but I was asked to take on some undergraduate teaching. I was already teaching neuroscience to undergraduates, and the people said, oh, we're desperate for a module. You can teach whatever you like to the undergraduates. So I thought about it, and then I thought, well, the thing I'd really like to teach is positive psychology. In fact, I quite like to teach a module on positive psychology. They call me a paper on positive psychology here. I don't know if many of you have come across positive psychology, but it's something that I was very, very excited to discover. And it dates from about, I suppose, Marty Seligman's presidential address to the American Psychological Association. It's just the turn of the century, 1999-2000. So it's quite a recent phenomenon in psychology. I would say it's essentially good psychology, because it's pretty ethical. It's very empirical. It's conceptually getting there. The only thing that's perhaps slightly questionable about it is that it probably is a little bit morally prescriptive. Not intentionally so, but it can't help but be so, because it's positive. So it values the good. And it's a psychology that arose as a reaction against the negative bias in psychology for the last 100 years. The sort of psychology that says, well, it looks as if you're doing this out of kindness, but actually you're just reworking some life script to do with desire for your parent of the opposite sex as a child, and it's all kind of defence. So it's very kind of miserable account of the way the world is. So a lot of the kind of suspicion that's there in psychology of goodness, which, you know, resonates quite well with some actual kind of Christian worldviews about human nature being depraved. And The other thing about positive psychology was a reaction against psychology being perceived as a therapeutic enterprise. That what psychologists did was they fixed broken people. That was the job. And that really drove me mad, working in churches, and people always assume that if you're going to do any psychology, it's to do with helping people who have mental health problems or personality disorders. Well, and it's about the dark side anyway. And the positive psychology movement actually was saying psychology should never have been about that. And it kind of got hijacked after the Second World War because of funding issues. Actually, it should always have been about helping people flourish. It should have been about documenting what it is that means that most people are resilient, that most people survive awful things and manage to go on. And if survive and cope, and in some cases be transformed and grow. You know, why is it that most people who are exposed to terrible trauma don't develop post-traumatic stress disorder? Why is it that most people who are exposed to terrible life deprivation don't develop depression? You know, we've not been interested in that. We've been interested in what makes people depressed and miserable and traumatised, and not what keeps them resilient. And so I taught this course on positive psychology, and positive psychology is very concerned with virtue. It organises its ideas around virtue, and then on the idea of character strengths, which are analogous to personality traits. But it rather sidesteps the idea, I think, of what character is. But in a way, it doesn't really matter if you're a psychologist, if you're a pragmatic psychologist. It's interested in the question of what is it empirically. First of all, how can we document what's good about people? And second, because it's very poorly documented. And secondly, how can we help to support what is good in human nature, in human behaviour? So I taught this course for a year to undergraduates who were quite interested in it. In the British sense of the word quite, that means not very interesting. And they liked it because it was cheerful. But they weren't blown away by it. And at the same time, I was teaching, in my other job, part-time seminarians who knew nothing of this work in positive psychology. And I thought, this is mad. I'm teaching people about good character and how to support it and how to grow in virtue in this essentially secular setting. And my seminarians are not getting this information. And I just thought it was wrong. And so I started to change my teaching in the seminary to make it much more around ideas drawn from positive psychology. And so I wrote in the end, the book emerges from that attempt to use positive psychology as part of teaching spirituality and formation in a seminary. So the book itself is in three parts, and the first part talks about the nature of formation. What do we mean by formation? The second part looks at the Christian's call to grow up into Christ, to be perfect, to be mature, to imitate Christ. And then following from that, the third chapter that asks the question, well, if it is true, I think I've demonstrated in my second chapter, that we are called to grow up into Christ, to imitate Christ, not only to imitate Christ, but actually picking up the orthodox idea of theosis, that in a sense to be drawn into the Godhead. What is Christ like? What is this person? What is the nature of the character of Christ? So, in the third chapter, I try and explore the character of Christ, which is, you know, not an enterprise without its pitfalls. But I do have a fairly systematic method or set of criteria for drawing out the things that seem to be important to do with the New Testament witness to Jesus of Nazareth. And these are the characteristics that I ended up with. So first one is intimacy with what I've called the holy other. So that's a pun on Rudolf Otto's holy other, Gans Andere. Humility, a type of humble power. Something about attentiveness to the natural world and the social world. Something about balance between engagement and withdrawal, going up the mountain, coming down, and being engaged with the crowds. hospitality. It's quite clear that Jesus shows hospitality, interestingly, mainly by visiting people rather than by hosting people. So there's some interesting stuff going on there. Of course, Jesus didn't have a house, so in the conventional sense, he couldn't be a host. So it's interesting to see how he manages that. Compassion, that's systematically attributed to Jesus, as it is attributed to the God of the Old Testament. I mean, there's something very theological going on there. But the emotion that's most consistently attributed to Jesus, and there's not much emotion talked about in the New Testament, in the Gospels, is compassion. Then there's something that I have called non-retaliation. And I was tempted to look at forgiveness there, but when I came to look at the Gospels, I discovered that you only get forgiveness really in the Synoptics and really only in Luke. And there is no forgiveness in John's Gospel, apart from one verse, which is astonishing. It tells us the lens through which we read the Bible, which you think there ought to be more. And it's at the end of John's Gospel when Jesus breathes on the disciples and he says, you now have authority to forgive sins. Apart from that, the word is never mentioned. So it's primarily a Lucan idea, but it leaches out into Mark and Matthew as well. But there is something about, and it's not in Paul either, forgiveness. So there's something about, it's not quite forgiveness, but something I've called a non-retaliative stance. There's certainly wisdom, and there's something about, and this is the most characteristic thing, I suppose. Well, maybe it's not, actually. The intimacy with the Father is perhaps the most characteristic thing. But maybe it's an inclusio, because this thing about transformation, the transformation of suffering, is also absolutely central to the character of Christ. So these are the headings that I came up with, very broad headings. And then in part two of the book, I look at some psychology. So I kind of park those headings and then I say, well, we know this is what we think Christ is like. If we want to imitate Christ, if we want to be like that, if we want to cultivate those kind of, let's call them virtues for now. The virtue isn't the best word, I think, for those themes. What do we bring to the table in doing that? Because knowing something about ourselves may help us in that enterprise. And so I look at temperament and personality traits, the big five model of personality. I look at attitudes and skills, and then I look at the thing that the positive psychology movement has invoked, things that they call character strengths, which are somewhere between a personality trait and an aptitude or skill. So they are, positive psychologists would say, character strengths are personality traits on which we place moral value and which can be cultivated through habitual practice. I also look at understanding ourselves in terms of narrative, because most theories of personality nowadays emphasise narrative above all else, how we make stories about ourselves and about our communities. And it's particularly important in Christian contexts. I don't know what kind of church tradition you're from, and it's different in different church traditions, but in the evangelical tradition, giving your testimony is a key part of explaining who you are. You have to tell your story, and you have to tell it in a certain kind of way to fit. And you craft it, not in a cynical way, but you're very aware of what the expectation and form of that story must be. And then I look at something about process. How do we grow? What does it mean to grow psychologically? So when I'm teaching up at Cuddesdon, I kind of say, if you want to understand personality, you need to think about it like a layer cake. And it's really complex. And, the basic things we're given biologically are our temperaments, our skills, or our aptitudes that we develop into skills in our trades. There's something about the goals that we habitually set ourselves and our values that is crucial. There's the stuff that happens to us, and particularly in childhood. So I talk a lot about attachment theory and how our attachment, our experience of our parents plays out in adult life with other people, but plays out also in the expectations that we have of how God is, how ready we are to trust God or not. And the kind of dissonance you get sometimes when people say, I know God loves me because the Bible tells me so, but my heart tells me that he thinks I'm worthless. And we've all come across people like that who it feels very hard to shift, and indeed it may be part of your own story. And then sticking with story. There's something about the story that we tell that brings all of these other things together into a whole. So that's kind of our temperament, our character, our stories, our strengths. But the process is a dynamic process, which in all the spiritual traditions, journeying is a key metaphor for spiritual growth. And I pursue the question of what is the nature of the journey psychologically? What does the path look like? And I suggest actually the path looks rather more like that than it does like the previous pictures. And that, you know, the spiritual life, and indeed actually psychological growth in general, often it's about going back to where you started from, but seeing it in a different kind of way with new insights. It's often disorientating. You go through periods where you just feel utterly lost before things fit again. Now that first picture I showed you was a picture of the road to Emmaus, which is this absolute, almost fundamental picture of what goes on in Christian growth, which is a journey. And Christian journeys are punctuated by moments of epiphany, which of course is what happens on the road to Emmaus. Literally, the disciples' eyes are kept from seeing who Jesus is. And then there's a revelation, and they see. And therefore, the nature of seeing and how that relates to journeying and perspective is something I explore in quite a lot of depth. And what I look at is how some of our spiritual traditions actually are intentional ways of helping us shift perspective so that we put ourselves in the right place to receive an epiphany. So, having done all that groundwork, then I look at these characters of Jesus, that I come back to these characteristics. And in the last part of the book, I take each one and I look at the nature of this particular characteristic of Christ that we're asked to imitate. And that's one of my criteria for selecting them, that Jesus says, do this. I want you to do it too. And I bring what we know from psychology to bear on each of these. On the whole, I use positive psychology, but for some of them, I'm using other sorts of psychology because it's more appropriate. And I call that third chapter third section, Cultivating the Fruit of the Spirit, because I want to capture the tension between a theology that's based on grace, where it's the Spirit that is at work in a work of transformation, and the fact that we're required to help the Spirit along, and that the tension that creates for us. And I think the idea of cultivating fruit is a helpful idea in that context. I also look at recognising fruit and suggest that we need to understand something about temperament and personality to help us, to free us up from thinking that people exhibit the fruit of the Spirit in only one kind of way. So the examples I've got there, which are from Paul's list in Galatians, is, you know, what does it mean to show the fruit of peace? It might be that you have to be actually quite assertive and angry to be a peacemaker. Or it might be that you have known that you're just very quiet and you do it quietly. And some of this will relate to your personality, but it will also depend on the situation in which you're called to show this fruit. Love. Some people show love, very affect-laden love. Some people show love through practical activities. That's how they do it. And joy, perhaps the most contentious one. What does joy look like? And I suggest that not only do individuals have differences in how they express these things, but that communities have differences, and there are cultural differences across churches. And that it's easy to be judgmental of other individuals and other cultural groups within the church, because we mistake personality traits for fruit of the Spirit. And suggest that really we need to perhaps respect and understand differences a little bit more. So, cultivating the fruit of the spirit. Just in the introduction to my third part, I just explore the context in which that list that we know very well from Galatians of the fruit of the spirit sits. And it sits in a kind of, as you know, in Galatians, a very polemical kind of place, where Paul is opposing both the flesh and the law, with and works of the law, with the spirit and the fruit of the spirit. And the emphasis is on the fact that these are our organic, natural outworkings of the act and the spirit of our life. They're not works, but also that morally they're not fleshly. There's a high moral valence on the fruit of the spirit. Just suggesting there that the real tension, again, between having a proper self-consciousness, understanding our personalities, understanding the building blocks that we bring and the gifts that we bring, and yet not becoming obsessed by them, and understanding that the need for us as individuals to have a good awareness of our own strengths and weaknesses is not is to understand ourselves better, but to place what we have at the service of the community and of the mission of God in the world. And essentially, it's about bringing strengths to the table and being aware that there are some things we habitually do that get in the way of what God is wanting to do in the world. And this brings us, I guess, to the character strength. I wanted us to spend a little bit of time on, so maybe the next 5-10 minutes before we have a bit more discussion. And I thought I would just look in slightly more detail at the idea of humility. And humility is a character in the Values in Action. This is from Positive Psychology, Peterson and Seligman's very famous taxonomy now of character strengths. Humility is up there as a really important one. And it's the second one on my list in terms of what we know about Christ. And it's a characteristic that throughout the New Testament people are exhorted to embrace. So here is one from Ephesians. So it begins, this long passage, Ephesians 4, with humility. It actually goes on to talk about spiritual gifts and growing up into maturity in Christ, which is what the whole enterprise is about. I'll miss the next slide because we're running a bit short of time. This one is, perhaps if anything, if we think about humility in the New Testament, this is the place we would naturally perhaps go, which is Philippians. And it's Paul saying, asking the Philippians to be humble and pointing them immediately to the example of Christ and his humility. So absolutely saying, imitate Christ, have the mind in you. Sorry about the typo up there. This is a depiction of, first of all, it's not a depiction, it's a picture of where the people think the Garden of Eden was, and then it's a depiction underneath of the sin of Adam and Eve, which I understand to be intimately connected with the idea of shame. So the hiding from God in the garden, fear of exposure. The more and more I think of the Genesis narrative in chapter 3, the more that I think what's wrong there is not so much the taking of the fruit, but the not owning up to it and what happens afterwards. And I started to play with the idea of what would have happened if God had said, had come back and said, where are you? And Adam and Eve had said, well, you know that fruit that you asked us, that tree that you asked us not to pick the fruit from? We did. We're really, really sorry. What might have happened then? But they don't. The point is they don't. They have a notion of God, which means that they have to hide. This picture is the kind of counterpoint to that, and it picks up the Philippians passage. This is the Garden of Gethsemane. And the reason that I place the idea of humility straight after in the characteristic of Christ, his intimacy with his Father, is because the humility of Jesus comes from, as I understand it, his trust in his Father. And the work of Christ, who is the last Adam, according to Paul, reveals something of this aspect of his character. Because when he is in his garden, he calls out to his Father. And there's a whole lot about, in this Philippians passage, about the nature of Christ's death on the cross, which is a death that involves exposure and shame. So many of you who know the New Testament will know that in that Philippians hymn, that little phrase right at the end, even death on the cross, is thought to be a Pauline interpolation into a pre-existing hymn. As if Paul is wanting to emphasise it's not simply Christ's obedience, it's the nature of the shame of his death that is part of his humility, but as also we know from elsewhere in Paul, it's part of what saves. And this passage in Philippians, so I'll read it, let the same mind be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who though he was in the form of God, did not regard equality with God as something to be exploited, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, being born in human likeness, and being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. It's the first half of that hymn in Philippians. So just unpacking that hymn a little bit more, the humility of the incarnation is expressed in Christ's attitude to his divinity. He wears it lightly. He did not think equality with God a thing to be grasped. His free choice to set aside his entitlement, specifically his entitlement to be served. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. And his ultimate willingness to take on the shame of the world, as I've alluded to in the humiliating nature of his death. And I suggest that the humility of the Christian is not the same as the humility of Christ, because we do not have divinity to set aside, for start off. And so the thing that we are asked to sit lightly to is our sense of self-worth or self-esteem. And the thing that we are asked to set aside is our ego, especially a sense of entitlement, which is a mark of narcissism. And we are called to a willingness to embrace shame where it happens. So I will need to just draw to a close, but there's just I just want to make a few points, and then perhaps we can discuss this more. There is a kind of a difficulty in some Christian circles, or perhaps in all Christian circles, with the idea of humility set against the idea of self-esteem. And this is a definition of self-esteem from a book that I and my husband wrote quite a long time ago now, but it's essentially saying self-esteem, it's a global judgment about the self that you're worthwhile, that you're worthy, essentially that you're worthy of love. And it has an impact on how you feel about yourself and the way the world is. And we know from research in psychology and in mental health in general that positive self-esteem is good for us. So it's associated with assertiveness, resilience, and good scholastic and vocational attainment. People try harder if they have positive self-esteem. Because they have an optimistic view of their impact on the world and on the way they are seen. They take more risks. Negative self-esteem, on the other hand, is associated with all sorts of awful things. People with low self-esteem tend to denigrate others and to be unkind about them. They are vulnerable to depression, anxiety, eating disorders, so things that turn you in yourself, but also to exhibiting violence. There's a gender difference there, substance abuse, and they don't do very well. They do less well scholastically and vocationally. So it's not good for us to have low self-esteem. But how does this relate to humility? Should we, if we are Christians, aspire towards trying to cultivate positive self-esteem, if actually the nature of Christ and our calling is that we are called to humility? So some questions that my husband and I posed in that book that we wrote in 2002, actually that was the second edition, so we wrote it a long time ago. Doesn't this ignore the fact that human nature is fallen or perhaps even depraved? Shouldn't we, as I've said, be cultivating humility? Doesn't Christ call us to lose ourselves? So why should we be building ourselves up? And if we do try and cultivate anything, and I've already alluded to this, what about where is there room for the grace of God? And just, I think, because it's probably the easiest if we discuss this, I'll just show you a couple of slides and then stop. A response to this, I guess, from the positive psychology community would be that if we understand humility aright, we understand it as something that is actually rather like, much more like positive self-esteem than it is like negative self-esteem. So although humility frequently is equated with a sense of unworthiness and low self-regard, theoreticians view true humility now, understanding it better, as a rich, multifaceted construct that entails an accurate assessment of one's characteristics. That's the key thing about it, accurate self-assessment. An ability to acknowledge limitations, and, isn't it interesting she uses this phrase, a forgetting of the self. And Peter Hill and his colleagues draw out three aspects of humility. Again, seeing yourself realistically, not being preoccupied with yourself. Key thing about low self-esteem is you think about yourself a lot because you say you're no good. So busy thinking how rubbish you are that you are as self-obsessed as someone who's saying how good they are. And being open to and learning from others is the third point that they say. Now, I do have a very complicated slide, which I'll pass over, but what it lays out is the complexity of the relationship between narcissism, pride, low self-esteem, humility, and the fact that they relate to early childhood experiences of being loved unconditionally. And again, we can talk about that in discussion. But I just want to finish with this quotation from Romans chapter 12, which I think is the key to humility. Paul's phrase about thinking of yourself with sober judgment, about being realistic. And going back to the Philippians passage, where Paul says, do not think of think of others as better than yourself. And doesn't say think of yourself as worse than others. So a key mark of humility is thinking about others, not thinking about yourself. And the reason I focused on humility was because it seems to me that if we understand humility right, then it put us in a better position to think about all the other Christian virtues that we want to cultivate. We need to have a humble attitude to the whole process, so we need to consider humility pretty early on. And I think it's really interesting that at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, you have two things happening. Sorry, this is preaching, and I will stop in a minute. You have his baptism, where he is told he is loved unconditionally and that his Father is pleased with him. You are my beloved Son, and I am well pleased with you. And then immediately after that, he's driven into the desert, and he then deals with these questions about what it means to be the beloved Son of God and the temptation to narcissism. And before he starts his public ministry, he's dealt with this issue of humility and narcissism. And so for us, as we imitate him, that's kind of, we start with intimacy with God, and the next step along the road is to think about how that impacts on humility. So I'll stop there so that we can have a discussion of some of the things that I have laid out for you. Thank you.
Thanks so much. So any questions, I'll bring it to you.
And I'm aware that I did, you know, I've covered quite a lot and I whizzed over something, so if there's any points that you want me to expand upon that would be helpful, I'm happy to do that.
Just in this idea of cultivating virtues, and you mentioned the Holy Spirit and pneumatology, and I wonder just kind of the how you would articulate kind of that balance between mythology, grace, and then the practices of spirituality, and how the cultivation happens.
I think I was in a completely different context. I had to give a talk on mindfulness to another group, and I was kind of saying that the practice of mindfulness, which is really popular now, and again, in some church circles, people are very suspicious of it. In another church circles, they welcome it uncritically. I see it as a fairly neutral kind of practice, and I said, and the important thing about both mindfulness, which is a kind of fairly neutral secular practice, and Christian meditation, which is Christian but meditation, is that neither of them are prayer. And as I was kind of answering this question, I kind of, in the end, said, well, when you do Christian meditation, it's a bit like saying, speak, Lord, your servant is listening. So it's putting yourself in a position to pray. It's putting yourself in a position to hear the Spirit. Because, you know, if physically I want to hear better, I do things like you know, we do things to attend. How do we attend to the voice of God? And spiritual practices are one way that I guess we do that. So there's something about attending. There's something about at the beginning of the book I talk about the process of formation as being a cooperation between God and us. It's always cooperative. It's not God doing things to us, and it's not us doing stuff ourselves. And I think the story of the feeding of the 5,000 sets that out really clearly. You know, I've talked about that before. That Jesus, you know, the people are hungry, and Jesus does not magic food from nowhere. He says, give me the little stuff that you have, and then I will do with it what I will. And that's the pattern, it seems to me, of the Christian life. I don't have a metaphysics for exactly how it works, but the other metaphor that I have, I've got a copy of the book here, is at the beginning of the book, I asked them to reproduce Holman Hunt's picture, which many of you will know, The Light of the World. It's not reproduced very well, but it's in Keble Chapel, and it's dead famous. And it's actually, most people think it's a horrible picture. But the point of the picture is, you know, aesthetically, it's not fashionable. The point of the picture is that Jesus is knocking on this door, but there is no handle. And people are always say, there's no handle, the handle is on the inside. And there's something in there, in the chapter when I'm looking at the light of Christ and epiphanies, and, you know, about we can't do anything without the light of Christ. We cannot see properly without the light of Christ. But actually, for him to shine it, we have to open the door. There's a sense. And the opening of the door, openness is a really interesting psychological concept. You know, it's one of the big five personality traits. Openness is a mark of children. It's a mark of certain points in child development. It's what happens to us after trauma. Because the world has been thrown up, you know, and you just don't know what's what. Instead of it all being closed down because you've got your routines and you know what to depend on, you know the way the world works, you're disorientated and your mind and concepts become fluid, and there's then a space for the Spirit to work. So I don't mean a God shape, a God of the gaps, but I'm speaking metaphorically. It's how you become open and then how you work with God and not against God. It seems to be the enterprise, and I think there is some psychology to bring to bear on that.
So the follow-up, like, does positive psychology, they, from some of what I've read about positive psychology, they offer some exercises and practices too. I wonder if there's a way to kind of bring in Christian understanding of
they are funny, the positive psychology. As some of you will know, they have this whole thing on gratitude. So why don't you count your blessings? You know, we, of course, we don't believe in God necessarily. If you believe in God, that's fine, but we don't. But you know, just look at the world as if it were a gift, and you'll find actually it works really well for you. Mm-hmm. And you could be, you want to say, well, actually Christians have been doing this for thousands of 2,000 mm-hmm. years. There's a weird natural theology at work there. Yeah. You know, a bit like Sabbath is good for people, counting your blessings is good for people. There are these signs of transcendence there that I think work at a mundane level. They help us psychologically. So, well, hey, why not give them a whirl? But theologically, there's something much bigger going on.
I was wondering how much of our character will shape our spiritual experience, or the other way around, how much will our decision to become a Christian have a long-term effect on our character?
I think our if I just part the character thing to start with, the personality thing, which I would say is slightly different from character, but personality will definitely shape our spiritual life, it seems to me. And if I include in personality our early experiences that I mentioned before, then there's lots of evidence to indicate that people's God images have a relationship that's predictable to their experience of their parenting. Particularly, you know, readiness to trust God. If the people who brought you up have not been trustworthy, it's going to be much harder to trust God than it is if people have always been trustworthy. That's just kind of how we are. I think our it's obvious to me that introverted people tend to prefer contemplative worship, tend to like going on retreat, tend to be attracted to certain styles of community worship in churches, and extroverted people will tend to be attracted to others. So in terms of personality traits, I think that it mirrors how people are. It can be where it becomes then dangerous is where you start thinking God is really like that, you know, that God is really an extrovert because you are, or vice versa, or projecting onto other people what are actually only personality traits and not anything to do with the spiritual life of the nature of God. What they are is the way we, in our particular culture, with our particular psychology, live them out. And there is some little bit of research that suggests when people are converted, their personality doesn't change.
Doesn't.
Yeah. So, and if you think about, the obvious example is St. Paul, which is, I know, is a bit, you know, it's always, but St. Paul doesn't seem to change in the sense that he's still difficult. He's still passionate. He's still absolutely committed. He's still probably introverted. But what does change is his goal. So, you know, our values change utterly on conversion. So it's perhaps that aspect that changes. But there is a suggestion that of all the big five, and I do mention this in the book, so the big five are openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, neuroticism, and agreeableness. Openness is one that might change, just to go back to the previous comment. Now, character, which is different from personality, which is to do with, in psychological terms, your natural aptitudes to certain sorts of morally valued strength, so that certain people will be particularly creative, or particularly humorous, or particularly wise, or whatever it is, that these develop, you know, that if you pay attention to them, they will develop, and if you do it within a faith context and point of faith, they will grow. If talking theologically, I think God, these are all human things we bring to the table. Very often God works with utter rubbish and transforms it, so there is no predictable way, but I think there are different ways in which what we bring filters how we relate to God, and it has a massive impact on it. And as I keep saying, I think the danger is that we mistake our psychology for the spirit, and then we set up norms. And that's why, so I think what's colouring me here is because I worked for so long with people who were depressed. And it's very hard to be in a Christian community where joy is meant to be being happy all the time if you are depressed. It's intolerable. And what happens if people simulate it? And it's not real. But actually, if joy isn't that, perhaps joy is something really quite different. So we don't need to. Knowing more about the psychology, in a sense, helps us stop being distracted by the psychology, I think is what I want to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about shame and how to understand that from a Christian psychologist's point of view. It seemed at first it was a negative thing with Adam and Eve and their response in the garden. And then you mentioned a little bit later about that we, you know, how we sort of interact with shame as sort of part of our Christian journey.
Yeah,
like that.
I think
is it a useful reaction?
I think shame is essentially, I think shame is bad. much in the book. I say, I actually, when I'm talking about the interacting with shame, the last thing you said, I say, remember it's bad. I think there are, I think perhaps, you know, since I wrote it, even since I wrote it, it's not that long ago, it doesn't take long for the book to go to press, I think I'd still want to nuance the shame thing even more. I think there are times when it is appropriate to be ashamed of oneself, but, or to use that phrase, but actually, generally speaking, I think it's a really bad thing. And what I mean by that is that I think shame is about a kind of self-loathing. It's a kind of sense that you are unlovable, perhaps irredeemable, which is why you have to hide. Because if you're exposed, nothing good can come of it. All that will happen is will be your, you know, utter worthlessness will be revealed. And in the book, and in the quite a lot of psychologists, would contrast shame with guilt and say that guilt is not always healthy, but often a very healthy thing to feel. And I think when I was saying about Adam and Eve was, it would have been good if they... It would have been interesting to see what would happen if they showed a bit more guilt and a bit less shame and how that might have been addressed. And what I mean by that, and that's what that very long diagram was about, was that guilt is what you feel when in a relationship which is essentially okay, but where you transgress and you then want to make amends for what you've done. Whereas shame is a sense that the relationship isn't okay, and therefore you keep it on the road through essentially a lie, and you're always frightened that the lie will be revealed and the relationship will break. Whereas in a secure relationship, it's actually fairly easy to say, not fairly easy, but it's relatively easier to say, I did this, and I'm sorry, and it can then be dealt with. And I think one of the things that leads me to say that is the structure of the Lord's Prayer, where you have a request for forgiveness quite late. So you have you start with Father, which is about this intimate relationship, and then you go through the kind of family stuff about the kingdom and a way of life and asking for bread, and then only after that do you say there are things that are wrong that need to pay attention to, which seems to me to imply a relationship that is one of unconditional love, but within which things go wrong and where those things have to be dealt with, which is contrasted in a relationship that's founded on conditional love. So you're only loved if you're good enough or if you make yourself good enough. And the real fear is that you'll be found out, so you won't have made yourself good enough, and then shame kicks in. So I actually think there's layer upon layer about this shame thing, right from the beginning in the garden, but right the way through in the gospel narratives, for instance, in the story of the taking of the woman, woman who's taken in adultery, and the way that Jesus deals with shaming there, and very explicitly in Paul, when he uses the idea of boasting to repudiate the tendency to shame, and the nature of Christ's death, which is above all shameful, which is what, you know, stops Paul initially being able to see it for what it is. And the transforming nature of the death is something about how that shame is dealt with once and for all, that there is no longer any need to hide. And I think the problem with the way that we often do church is that we don't make that sufficiently clear. So we imply people have to make themselves good enough. So we, for instance, in the Anglican rites, usually confession comes very near the beginning of the conversation with God, which is not where it comes in the practice of Jesus. I don't know if that answers, that pulls it out. I mean, do you want to come back about the shame thing?
Yeah, well, I was interested in what... So you said there are some cases in which it would be appropriate.
Yeah, so in terms of following Christ, then, it seems to me that because we follow Christ into dark places, we may have to follow Christ into shameful places. Well, we are not any more ashamed of the gospel, to quote Paul. But we may be in a place where people will treat us as if we were shameful, and we will be required to take
because of the gospel.
Yeah. So the example that I give is perhaps being called to work alongside paedophiles, for instance, and to stand in solidarity with them, not in terms of what they have done, but in terms of caring for and befriending. That would be an example of, I guess, something that would bring potentially bring shame on the person who did it. I mean, I think we could think of lots of other examples. So I think what I'm trying to make clear there is that in terms of our relationship with God, we shouldn't ever feel ashamed, I don't think. But we may be called to embrace shame, to stand in a shameful place for the sake of the gospel.
How about in our relationship with one another? When we have, so for example, from one Christian to another, we then, I guess, strive to see one another through God's eyes without shame then, sort of as loved and forgiven?
Absolutely, yeah. As loved unconditionally, I think.
Right. So then shame is, I guess, you would say, is inappropriate, except when taking on shame for the sake of the gospel.
I think, you can play with words a little bit. Sometimes one just says, I feel so ashamed of myself.
Right.
From a position of quite robust self-esteem, it seems to me. So you're actually saying to yourself, well, I'm better than this. And that kind of turn of phrase, I think, is actually okay. It's the dark shame that we daren't even name. It's almost, you can say, well, I'm ashamed of myself because I know I'm better than this. Kind of, it's very lightweight. But it's the shame. I think, again, it's coming out of the work I've done so long with psychiatric patients, really, the terrible shame that people carry. And some of that shame is because they have done terrible things, but often the shame is because terrible things have been done to them. And they internalise it. And they see the world as a place that they can only be loved if people don't know them. If they can build enough barriers or do enough things. And that's a caricature of medieval Catholicism in a way. If you do enough things, you make yourself okay with God. But actually, I think it goes much deeper than that. I think it's part of the human psyche. And I think it's part of a fallen human nature, is that we just don't believe God. That if people really knew everything about us, they really would love us. A friend of mine called Nick Gibson, who's a psychologist of religion, tells this story about when he was at St Aldate's and one evening in the service, and the pastor there said, hands up if you think God loves you. And the congregation all shot their hands up, and then he said, now hands up who thinks God likes you. And it was... they weren't tutored in the right answer to start with. And then, well, should he like me? No, because I'm worthless. But no, I should be, because I'm saved. Well, and am I likeable? I think that's what the gospel is. Yes, you are. And then you think, well, it can't be that. How could it possibly be that? And so you build all these other things. But I think that is what the gospel is, actually.
How would you characterize Judas's response, like the taking of his own life, in response to what he did? Would that be an instance of shame as well? Because this just comes out of a recent conversation with a friend.
I've got a student who's doing a dissertation on Judas, actually. Could Judas be redeemed as a kind of a question? I think there's some scapegoating going on with Judas. I think, that you read the gospel narratives through the first Christians who just, hated him, especially in John's gospel, absolutely hated him, as one does with traitors. He probably accurately appraised the fact people thought he was worthless and he killed himself. What did God think about Judas? What did Jesus think about Judas? We don't know. But is it? Do you know the Jesse tree? I wish I could remember it now. There's a tradition. It hasn't any basis in reality, but there is a kind of Christian story of the rehabilitation of Judas, because people have been so uneasy with his story over the centuries, which is around the legend of the Jesse tree, and I cannot remember what it is, but, and there's a lovely poem where I believe Jesus comes and meets Judas, and they are reconciled. We just don't know. But I think, yeah, if... I think there's shame there. I think there's probably shame with Peter as well, that he denies Jesus, actually.
So in a way, it could play a positive role, in the same way that, you know, the embarrassment you feel when you find out that a ton of feathers actually is the same weight as a ton of bricks, right? And that has sort of a level,
yes,
has effect of adjusting you with reality.
Yeah.
So morally, that could be in a, you know, in a far more intense sense, it could play a role in terms of.
I think you're right, and that's why I'd want to nuance what I say about shame. That kind of, well, I suppose there's a definite difference between what psychology would call trait and state. So I said trait shame probably isn't good, but state shame, you know, the odd experience of the feeling of shame, acute shame, may actually be potentially transformative. It's really interesting that in the story in John's Gospel, you know, where Jesus and Peter come together over breakfast, while I was looking for forgiveness, that, I then realised that word is never mentioned in relation to that story, and yet we kind of read it as the forgiveness of Jesus by, of Peter by Jesus. But it's actually a kind of, it's a meeting. I'm not sure that relationship was broken. You know, something really, really bad happened, but it didn't break it. It clearly didn't break it. And actually, what's interesting, I've just thought about that, is that what does Peter do when he sees Jesus on the shore? He doesn't go, oh, flip, you know, I denied him, and get down in the boat. He jumps out and he runs to him. Like the kid in my bed. I just thought of that, actually. And that's how I understand faith. It's that, not that. But maybe that's enough.
Actually. Interesting, he wept bitterly as well.
Yeah.
Before that. So
yeah.
There's the moment of compunction.
So that's, yeah, so remorse, which is a different thing again, is potentially transformative. So in the chapter on forgiveness, I actually trace what, there's quite a lot of research on what happens with remorse, that remorse can go two ways. It can then make you decide to change, but it can also flip you into a depression where there's no point changing because I'm rubbish. So you know, one has to kind of, you see remorse in the story of the woman who washes Jesus' feet, and there it becomes closer to being a gratitude. And I think you see a kind of similar thing with Zacchaeus as well. But, yeah. That's interesting. I've just thought about that thing in John's Gospel. I'm going to have to go and think about it. That the initiative in that meeting actually is Peter's.
Oh, sorry, can I ask one quick question about Judas? Isn't there a bit where Jesus says it would have been better for him not to have been
born?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty...
It's not good, is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's not very soft. How would you make sense of that? Or interpret that.
Yeah, I don't think I can make sense of it, and I wouldn't want to... I think it's this whole thing about the way we read the Bible is that, and I'm not just making a virtue, I don't think making a virtue out of necessity. I don't understand it, but I wouldn't want to ignore it, because I think it's part of the real story of who Jesus is. He doesn't say easy things, which is why the narrative, the legend of Jesse Tree is so lovely, but it's not actually biblical. You know, and maybe Jesus did meet Judas, and that's the kind of nice person he is, but maybe... I just don't think we'll ever get Jesus completely. And and you could do a lot of theology on it and make it okay, as with a lot of things that you read in the Gospels. But I think to come back to the openness and the spiritual discipline, and I do again mention this at one point in the book, how we read the Bible is part of that. And closing it down too quickly by saying, well, you know, Jesus is really nice, so I'll find a way of reading this that makes him stay really nice, is the way that we shut the door, actually. And so being able to say, I don't know, doesn't look good, but nevertheless I trust, seems to me to be what's required in the life of faith. It's the disorientating, difficult parts of those pathways that I was showing a bit earlier.
Thanks for your talk. was left with a question about knowledge of self. Your sort of answer to the question about whether we should have positive self-esteem was that humility might involve a sort of accurate self-assessment.
Mm.
Yeah, so I'm undecided on myself, so when if you could help, I mean, it seems that ours is an era maybe focused more on self-knowledge. Is it right to have sort of to seek proper self-knowledge, or is it better to sort of move towards forgetting self in some sense, or sort of knowing self through others, or being sort of other focused instead of sort of leaving behind a quest of self-knowledge?
I think that in order to leave yourself behind, you have to know a certain enough about yourself. I think to be able to set the ego aside, you have to have a kind of sense of who you are before you can give it up. And again, I say this because of working with people who've had difficult upbringings, that some of us have a clear sense of who we are. Many of us have really incoherent senses of self because of the nature of our family experiences or not experiences. You know, people who've been in and out of care or who have been neglected or abused. It's very difficult for them to set aside self and see self in relation to others because they just become a kind of screen on which other stuff is projected. So I think for each individual it's a different journey, but it's about, as I said on one of the slides, knowing enough of yourself to know what you genuinely bring to the community to enrich it. You know, because God has given you these gifts in the way that he's created you. To know enough about yourself to know that there are certain things you just keep doing that mess things up, so that you can be attentive to managing those or help asking others to help you manage them. And being secure enough in who you are so you don't use others as bit players in your game where you're trying to build a sense of self-worth, which happens a lot in Christian communities, that people will use positions to build a sense of self when they shouldn't be. You know, they should have got a secure sense of self from somewhere else other than the position they held, either, you know, in the secular world or in their church. So I think the mark of positive self-esteem is that it frees you up to be interested in other people, that genuinely interested. Does that unpack it enough for you?
So I don't know if you would have an example of sort of the right kind of self-knowledge as compared to a sort of egotism or...
Again, in the book, I give an example of how you might pray that you, as part of your giving thanks, you might give thanks for your own particular gifts alongside the gifts of all the other people in your community. That seems to me to express a kind of fairly healthy sense of self-esteem, rather than. The model that Jesus offers in Luke's Gospel of the Pharisee who says, I really thank you, I'm not like other people, because I do this, 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 which is all about, I'm good enough, look at me, compared with them who aren't. Or a prayer that says, they're so great and I'm just so rubbish, and then focuses on the ways in which I am rubbish. So it's something that it seems to me that places you in perspective and is prepared to say positive things about us. I think that's the thing we find really hard. British people find it hard to say positive things about ourselves. I know some people from some Oriental cultures find it even harder than British people to say positive things about themselves, and North Americans are caricatured as people who don't find it hard to say positive things about themselves. Nevertheless, genuinely, in relation to in our prayer life to God, I think we can learn something from the positive psychology movement and to say, thank you, God, for making me this way. Thank you, God, for my intelligence. And then offering it back. You know, it's not mine. That's the thing, that's the sitting lightly. Did not think equality with God a thing to be grasped. This is my gift, and I give it back to you and the community. And I think finding a language to think about the positive gifts that we have and the positive gifts other people have will help us pray better for them. and give thanks better for them. And there's quite a lot of evidence that we're very poor at articulating good things about ourselves and others. So there's far more words in most languages for negative qualities than there are for positive qualities. So we need to develop a vocabulary of positive qualities, if only to give thanks for other people, but I would suggest we also give thanks to what God has given us.
Thanks.
Okay, so, personally, addressing a point which came up earlier, do you think it would be helpful to distinguish between the state of shame and that which is shameful, as that which generally occasions shame, but if we have a Christ-like character, will not occasion shame in us?
I think the state trait thing is probably helpful. I think I'm probably loading too much on the words guilt and shame, which are strongly but not 100% related to two different kinds of psychological domain. And I would say that the one is related to the bad feelings we have in the context of a secure sense, either of who we are. You know, I'm ashamed of myself for wearing a polyester blouse when I only ever wear silk, you know, kind of shame. Or a secure relationship with someone else, where I might say, I'm really ashamed of the way I behaved to you last week, because it's not worthy of the relationship that we have. Those are both kind of relatives to secure ways of expressing shame, and the kind of pathological shame, which is the conviction that we are not worth anything. And I just think that goes so deep in all of us. You only have to have a few disasters, you only have to fail a few term papers, or be dumped by somebody, or just a little thing go wrong, and that voice which says, I'm a loser. It's constantly there. And for some of us, it's there very loud, but for others, it's fainter. But sometimes that's because we've done a whole lot of stuff to convince ourselves that we aren't a loser. And I think the only thing that repudiates that is unconditional love. And those of us who've experienced that in childhood or in family life are in a really much stronger position to repudiate it. So there's a kind of injustice in the world. And it's ultimately repudiated, it seems to me, by Christ. That's my understanding of actually the work of Christ. It's not the only thing he does, clearly, but it's a central part of it is a repudiation of this tendency to shame. So, yeah, I think, just to go back, I would probably nuance it a bit more and say there are contexts in which we might have a kind of state of what we would call shame, but located in a place of safety. I think, again, in the book, I kind of use this phrase, we probably ought to get into the habit of saying to ourselves and to other people, not, that wasn't good enough, or you're not good enough, but you are better than this, or you can do better than that. This sense that you are good and what you've done has fallen short of the good thing that God wants you to be, rather than you are bad, and this thing just shows how rubbish you are. It's almost the same, and yet it's a profoundly different way of articulating those two things.
Probably have time for one or maybe two more. We're just coming to the end of our time. I know there was one right here, then Carl, maybe those two.
I just wanted to come back to a question of methodology that you brought up at the beginning,
okay,
where you said kind of the empirical notion of psychology as presumably with kind of a secular theology there, in a way, and kind of a religiously plural understanding that science can feed into different kinds of worldviews. And then
so positive psychology would be a good example of that. Treat most religions as having more in common than distinctive.
Right. But I was just wondering, because I suppose, sorry if this is coming out kind of convoluted, but there's a sense in which there's a theology that underpins the notion of secular pluralism, and that the Christian position is one of declaring the truth of Christ, the fact of Christ, the historicity of Christ. And so to bring, I mean, I your presentation makes perfect sense to me because I see that you're bringing science within kind of a strong theological framework, which shows how, you know, understanding the psychology kind of actually and helps us to understand our real position in relation to God.
Yeah.
But I wonder how it works the other way from Christian theology into science, if it's only a one-way conversation where science can kind of feed into Christian theology, but Christian theology has limited
place. I think it has. I think it has a limited place.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about positive psychology, with its funny kind of they're all the same notion, is that it took a lot of its ideas from the Christian tradition. It looked at a whole range of traditions. It would say it looked at all representatives of all traditions. But amongst them, Christian theology, and particularly Aquinas, actually, because it fits that kind of view of the person, I think. So there's a sense in which it's drawn from, and there's a sense in which it's the secular world is prepared to have a conversation with. But of course it runs into problems when you have these truth claims. And when every concept that you might try and pillage and extract from its faith context actually will not be extracted when it's Christianity. So they managed to extract mindfulness from Buddhism with some difficulty. But they did. But they really can't extract anything from Christianity because we hold it so tight within our theological kind of nexus, really. Not much. Counting your blessings might be. You know, there are bits. So the question is then, how do you have that conversation? Is it a worthwhile conversation to have? I always frame these things in terms of Paul's conversation at the Areopagus, you know, where he just takes what's there in the secular world and says, well, you know, God's at work. Actually, if you have the eyes, coming back to Epiphanes, to see it, this points to God. If you don't have the eyes, it will only partially point to God, but actually he's not far from any one of us. And we're reaching out to him, and then we find he's there. So I think there's a kind of, in Luke's account of that, there's a kind of model for how it is done. And one of the interesting things about the speech on the Areopagus is that Paul talks about joy as almost a demonstration that God exists. He says, this is a gift of God in creation. It gladdens men's hearts. So he takes these positive emotions and says, who has given us this? So I would say it's quite a hard place to be, and the conversation is often on the terms of the other. But the alternative is not having a conversation. Or active hostility, so I prefer this, but I think it's limited.
No,
you're right to identify that.
Oh, thank you.
Do we have anyone who hasn't asked a question yet who really wants to? I should give it to you here. Because I think we have rivals for the last question, because I know you want to ask in with Carlos. So we'll let you fight to the death, and then whoever wins can ask. Do we have time for two more? Is that okay?
Yeah, it's fine.
All right. So either one of you, go ahead.
I was just wondering how generally you handle the sort of, I guess, competing pictures of the good life from... Mm-hmm. Positive psychology and then Christianity, because I guess positive psychology seems oriented around the picture of, you know, human flourishing or eudaimonia that could be, I mean, it could be egoistic, maybe it's not, maybe it has to not be egoistic to be successful, but
you can't, exactly that, you have to be humble and not egoistic in order,
yeah, right,
for
yeah,
self-interested
that's
reasons
of, yeah, yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's one of these interesting paradoxes. But sort of how do you kind of think about that alongside Christ's life and the fact that his, you know, communing with the Holy Other, his courage, his compassion, and all these sorts of things fit into a life that was pretty radically oriented towards the cross.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something, I mean, it's something of, I think, theoretical interest, but also, like, for me personally, like, great sort of pastoral interest.
Well,
because it seems like he's, you know, it's this sort of ultimate act of, you know, self-emptying.
Yeah, absolutely.
One way that some moral philosophers have put this is the question of moral saints and some of the virtue ethics literature, and this has been put to utilitarianism and deontic ethics as sort of a problem, that they kind of lead to this kind of radical picture of human life that really contradicts proper human flourishing. Mm. So I just wondering sort of how you kind of fit these things together.
Yeah, well, in the book, it's the last chapter, and I kind of think it's the last thing the disciples learn. So they learn about flourishing, and it looks like a bit like what we might secularise think human flourishing looks like, and then it gets turned on its head around that point of Caesarea Philippi. Really. You are the Messiah, it's all looking good. Actually, the nature of being the Messiah is this, not what we thought. In terms of Seligman's good life, so Seligman's idea of the good life is you've got hedonia, eudaimonia, and then meaning. And I think Jesus was quite good at hedonia, simple hedonic pleasure. And I don't think Christians are very good at the body and pleasure. And I think Christians flip between a kind of repressed anti-physicalism or problems with addiction. So there's something to be learned about what Seligman calls the pleasant life, how to inhabit pleasure well. I think the eudaimonia stuff, it's kind of... I think it is there. I think what's interesting about with Jesus is there's the life of Jesus and then there's the passion of Jesus. And I think the good life stuff actually fits quite well with the life of Jesus. But then when you move into the passion, you're going into a much deeper... you're moving up a gear, you're quantally up a gear into something you hadn't thought about when you entered. And I'm very interested in how Jesus calls the disciples gently and just says, oh, come with me and you can carry on fishing, it's fine, we're just fishing slightly differently. And they end up, in the story of Peter, extremely, you end up in a place you don't want to go, someone will lead you and take you where you don't want to go. And in within the umbrella of positive psychology, there is this sub-discipline, which is how I got into it, called post-traumatic growth, which is about how the only growth happens in the context of suffering. The only real authentic growth happens in the concept of suffering that is transformed. And it's not the main thrust of positive psychology, but it's a significant small part of it. And I think even there is something in the kind of natural order of things that points to a kind of that much, much greater depth in what the flourishing life might look like, which goes beyond what people, I think, like Marty Seligman, who's the main proponent of positive psychology, quite grasp. But there's other people working in that area. And the fact that Jesus, when he talks about what has to happen to him, points to the natural world and says, look, a seed isn't going to bear fruit if it doesn't fall into the grain of wheat, doesn't fall into the ground and die. The fact that he can do that shows that there is still in the natural order, there are pointers towards this paradoxical nature of what flourishing actually means. So I think there is room within that psychological endeavour for it, but it takes a lot of doing, and I think it's the last lesson, and it's clearly the hardest lesson we learn as Christians, is the way of the cross. Sometimes I think we face people with it too early. Sometimes we face them with, you're rubbish, and it's the way of the cross. Why would anyone become a Christian then if they would be masochists? It's not quite how Jesus invites people to the party. But it gets to the cross in the end. So I don't see how it cannot get to the cross. Do we have time for the last one?
If everyone's okay, if you have to slip out, that's fine. Sure, it's up to you though.
Okay, should we keep it brief? I'll give a brief answer. Okay, brief question, brief answer.
Oh, yeah, I know that we have an eager question asked for.
So, is there an important facet of your picture which you would call pride? And so, what is it?
Yes, it's on that funny little diagram. And it's what I would call pride is this thing where you, which is articulated in. So, what I call, if you go into the New Testament, into the Gospels, and look at caricatures of people with these conditions, I suggest that in the parable of the talents, the person who buries his talent in the ground and does nothing with it is the person with low self-esteem rather than humility, because he does not offer what he has. And in fact, it hides again, so there's this theme of hiding. And the caricature of the person with pride would be the person I've already mentioned, who is the Pharisee, who says, I thank you, I'm not like him. And I suggest that self-esteem, well, I suggest we know this, that when we talk about low self-esteem, it manifests in two ways. One is, I'm no good. Please don't ask me. I'm rubbish. I couldn't possibly do that. This may be a stupid idea, but I've been wondering this. That kind of, what I call preemptive strike, which, to be a bit controversial, I would say is more characteristically feminine. And then there's the, rather than the preemptive strike, there's the defensive kind of wall, which is, of course, I'm not rubbish, because look at my CV, or what you call resume. But look at what I have done. Look at who I am. Look at how important I am. And I say in the book, you don't have to be a psychologist to see often through that is people who are very insecure. So that's what I call pride. Some people use pride, just as we've been talking about shame as kind of positive and negative. Some people will say there's a healthy pride to be had. I think I've renamed that dignity, really. So I think... Last thing I would say is that when people encounter Jesus in the gospel, they always go away standing taller rather than ground down. Well, maybe not the Pharisees, but you know, people who have transforming encounters with Christ. And there's something there about how he raises us, even before he raises us in all these other theological ways, that people are raised to a higher stature and a greater dignity when they encounter Jesus. So to a good kind of pride. Which again tells us, and they can do more, and often they go on and do more. They, at the very least, they bear witness. But there's something about being raised, standing taller, and achieving a pride that is not, you know, that is a dignity and is not this kind of, I know I'm okay because they're rubbish, which is built into the academic system, and you will know it yourself. That's why we like women, particularly, like we do these magazines about celebrities who may look happy and beautiful and all the things we wish we could be but are actually really unhappy, so we can then feel better about where we are in relation to them. That's why we set celebrities up and then love to bring them crashing down. It's all part of that dynamic. I'm sure stop there, I think.
Well, there's, I think, more wine on the way. Hint, hint to any committee member who feels like running down grabbing. So, and therefore possibly more chance to approach Dr. Culkin afterwards. So, but thank you again for an excellent and a rich presentation. And
thanks for the question.
So thanks again.